Hello and welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for the Catbird Seat blog, the White Sox affiliate for the ESPN Sweet Spot Network in Arizona. I am Matt Adams, and with me today in New York City, more specifically, wait, are you in Brooklyn or Manhattan? I forget now.
I'm in Alphabet City, East Village of Manhattan.
Well, in Manhattan, we have Nick Schaefer.
Yeah, I mean, I could see Brooklyn from my window. If that counts.
Oh, yeah, it counts.
Yeah, I'm, you know, we're recording this on the heels of the very disappointing 5-4 walk-off loss where the White Sox were in Detroit. They were up 4-0 heading into the eighth. And Samardzija was left in while he imploded in slow motion. And then Putnam gave up a walk-off home run to superstar James McCann, bottom of the ninth.
Yeah, so there's things in that game that can be kind of talked about on a larger level for kind of pointing out how things are going for the season. So number one would, of course, be the Samardzija inning. So there's stages of that inning. I mean, the obvious knee-jerk reaction from fans is to immediately blame Ventura, which by the end of the inning, you definitely could make a case no matter who you are for that. I mean, he started that inning at what? Like 85 pitches or something, right? If that?
That's a very good question. I'm trying to see if I can pull that up elegantly. But he had been very efficient. I think he finished at like 110 or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. So the problem with
that, 110.
The problem with that is also it's when a guy like Samardzija is that efficient, it can be misleading because especially the way he's been going this year and not really missing bats like he has in the past, or rather in his last very successful season or his only very successful season, that was kind of the difference, right? Is him striking people out.
Yeah.
So. And what we've seen all year, even the one game that he's successful, is him just getting away with leaving things in the zone and having a, you know, a splitter that's not quite splitting. So still, I want to not jump on Robert Ventura immediately in that inning. But as things started to go sour, and they did so, I don't know, it was enough time for the bases to be loaded without a run being scored. So you would think someone would be prepared in the bullpen at that point to face, you know, the heart of the lineup.
Right, so there are a lot of places where, obviously with the benefit of hindsight, everything's easier. And Ventura basically said, you know, if I pull him and the guy who replaces him gives up the lead, then everybody screams at me for taking him out. Which, he's right on the one, but if he's actually, he should be trying to manage to win instead of trying to avoid criticism, and I guess he could argue that's what he was doing here. There's a couple of objective things that were working against Ventura leaving him in, though, at this point. And the fact was that, like, he said after the game, like, well, they can strike quickly. The problem is they didn't strike quickly here. They struck very slowly. The inning started with single, walk, single. Granted, those were ground ball singles, but, and so you could say, well, they didn't really make great contact of him, but the walk is there. That's troubling. Then there's the hit by pitch. It's still 4-1 there. There's none out. Bases are loaded. Miguel Cabrera's coming up. Once you're at that point, also, these are hitters now facing Samardzija for the fourth time today. And across the board, this is something we talked about when Sale's been left in too long. The Trout home run game is I think,
that game came into my mind immediately upon watching this one.
But hitters do so much better the third and fourth time they see a pitcher, and it makes a ton of sense why they would.
Sure.
That it's not just that the pitcher's fatigued, it's that they've seen his stuff. They've gotten used to what he's throwing. He doesn't have anything left hidden up his sleeve. And so that's one thing working against him. Just even if you think Samardzija is way better than your relievers, once you handicap him by having had them face him four times, that I think a lot of that advantage is eroded. Secondly, even though Samardzija had been efficient throwing a shutout, he'd given up a lot of deep fly balls he hadn't, there were a number of hitters who he hadn't really fooled. There were a couple, especially as the game was going on, there were a couple of 2-0 counts, 2-1 counts where there were pretty hard, sharply hit balls in the air to the warning track. Abbasale had to make a catch on one. Melky had to make a catch on one back there. So the warning signs were cropping up. And also, with, like I said, with the walk, the control flagging. And then the third thing is people were saying, well, you can't bring in Robertson there because then you'd have to have him get six outs.
Well, you very much can bring Robertson in there, and that really annoys me, that mindset, because, A, if he has to get six outs, you know, or if he has to try for six outs, you know, maybe he doesn't even have the opportunity to go, depending on how long it takes him to get there, fine. That's not something that's impossible to do. Also, how about just these three outs? I mean, this right. is the leverage situation.
Right. Once it's bases loaded, none out, with Kinsler coming up to face Samardzija for the fourth time, and you're up 4-0, theoretically, like, what if you bring in Robertson and he holds them to one or two runs? Yeah, it feels weird pulling your closer in the ninth in a, quote, save, you know, a save situation or whatever it would be. But if you win the game, nobody's in a position to, you know, if it's the mathematically correct thing to do, if it gives you the best chance to win, you should do it. I'd rather have the team's best reliever on in the eighth in this incredibly high leverage situation than, you know, just save him for, to what, face James McCann with nobody on, or J.D. Martinez? I mean, I'll take David Robertson against J.D. Martinez and Cespedes, like, any day of the week. I mean,
yeah, and there's a couple of things also with that is, I mean, with the six-out situation is, okay, you got a free day off yesterday. There's a scheduled day off tomorrow, so that makes a pretty ideal chance for him to actually stretch out and throw a few extra pitches.
Exactly. Yeah, that too.
There's a lot of things that people say with relievers being prepared, being very routine-driven, and not being able to perform when they're asked to do something that's out of their routine. So my biggest thing with that is, and there's probably something to that. I know there's something to that because I've heard actual relievers say that. But and I, the ones that actually are thinking about it are also saying, well, if we were just used to something else, we would get used to that too. So what better situation than what the Sox are in, where actually it doesn't matter if we win or lose any of these games. The White Sox can play these things and get this guy used to not having to set up for just, you know, for the ninth inning. Right now is the time to play with these things and get a guy's mindset ready for, you know, just to know that these things can happen and kind of shape guys up. I've been looking at the way Robin Ventura has been putting together the lineup for the last couple weeks, and he's changed it constantly. And that's a big thing he said coming up. When he first came up as manager, was like, guys are used to hitting in these spots. You know, we want to keep them comfortable. So right now, he's just throwing shit together because he just wants to see if anything will work. But at the same time, it's getting guys to not be like, oh, why am I not hitting fifth? I can't do this. Because now they're used to different things.
Right, and that always rung a little hollow to me. And like you said, I'm sure it's also on a case-by-case basis. I'm sure some players don't care. I'm sure some players care very much. I know Derek Jeter threw a tantrum every time they wanted to hit him leadoff, even though his profile was fantastic for a leadoff hitter. But, you know, selfless guy that he was, he really didn't want to do it. but I'm sure that some players don't really care because at the end of the day, as a pitcher, you're still going in there. You're trying to get people out. I guess there's the whole throwing out of the stretch versus the windup situation. But there's that. But if you're a hitter, I mean, you're going up and theoretically you're trying to not be out. That doesn't change wherever you're hitting. You know, you're trying to get a hit, you're trying to get a walk. And at the end of the day, it's you in the batter's box against a particular pitcher. And it's not like, oh, well, I'm not used to coming up in the second inning and come up in the first. Now I'm confused. No, you've been hitting baseballs your whole freaking life. I mean,
right. And that's, you know, but like I said, even the players that are kind of adhering to this sort of scheduling, they can get used to not adhering to it. They're going to get used to anything. If you put anything in front of a guy enough times, he's going to adjust to it. That's why he's there. He's there because he has the ability to adjust.
Right. And also with Robertson too, I mean, this isn't just, you know, okay, this is your run of the mill reliever. You spent $46 million on an ace reliever and he has been fantastic. If you can't use him here, why are you bothering spending $46 million on a closer? If you're scared, if you're trying to get an ace reliever because you say, we can't develop a guy like this, this is a rare commodity, he's worth sacking a second round draft pick for.
Right.
Then
and,
then why not now? If he can only come in with the bases empty, he's not that good.
Exactly. Yeah. He needs to, you know, you got to figure out if you can. Right now, get it.
Like, yeah.
You know, you have more years on this contract, you know, and this year, he's essentially, as far as paying a closer goes, it's useless to the White Sox. So they may as well start working out the type of value they can expect or shape the sort of value they want to receive moving forward, because it's not really going to matter what he does until next season. As far as the final record and where we go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a shame that I really hope that I can't think of a reason why you wouldn't bring Robertson in there unless it's fear of being second guessed. And if you're already managing from that perspective, then you're a liability. Well, because if you make the right, in baseball, there aren't a lot of decisions that are going to reward you as a binary yes or no type proposition, right? I mean, you can go in and say, okay, well, option A has a 35% chance of succeeding and option B has a 28% chance of succeeding. I should take the higher percentage, even though most of the time I'm going to get burned either way. And, yeah. but if you add up enough of increasing your probability, if you add up enough of those decisions, it's going to translate to better results over the course of the season. If you would rather take the option, the lower probability option that keeps you safer from criticism, you're not trying to win anymore. You're just trying to cover, it's just CYA then, and that's.
Right, which is the status quo approach, which is very common and becoming a little less common, which is nice amongst managers, but still. And Ventura's attitude towards it is interesting, as you pointed out from his press conference or his little addressing after the game, is he was basically like, I don't know. I mean, you guys are going to get mad no matter what. It's basically like, who, you know.
Right.
And that's, you know, that'd be a nice approach for the fans to take. Like, well, hey, you're going to lose, so who cares? But that's not what you want out of the manager.
No. I know right now, you know, I wasn't actually that fired up by this loss because I'm definitely at the point where it's gone on long enough. They've looked bad enough that I've given up on the season, and it's whatever at this point. But if, what were you going to say?
No, I was shifting gears, so you can go.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to talk about Ventura's position long term because we did have the headlines that, you know, every time, you know, early in the season when they start off really badly and the Brewers fired their manager, it kind of, people started looking at Robin and being like, oh, are we firing managers now? Well, this guy looks bad. And it didn't happen. And we had Sandberg resign from Philly. Granted, they are looking at a regime change with McPhail coming in as team president. And Sandberg, the difference between Sandberg and Ventura is that Sandberg has repeatedly pissed off his players. I think he even lost Chase Utley and Ben Revere, and those guys are apparently some of the more that's very hard to do, to lose those guys.
You at the very least need your on-field leaders to buy into your shit.
And those are apparently pretty mellow guys who are going to, unless something really bad is happening, are going to be on board, you know, and are going to be going to bat for their manager. So, you know, with him resigning, people kind of look, or, you know, looking over at Ventura, and then a game like today doesn't really help. So, what would you do if you were in charge, and what do you think will happen are the two different questions.
So my stance hasn't actually changed at all on Ventura, which is if he gets fired, cool. Let's bring in someone new. Let's bring in someone with a different outlook on things. Just kind of change it up, and it'll be interesting at the very least to watch kind of what develops from that. Also, if he stays, I don't know how much of a big deal it is because, like we discussed for this year, who cares, period. And then on a, you know, on a larger level, it's just, and I know we beat this into the ground a lot, but organizationally, there's a lot wrong here, and a manager is not going to fix it. It's literally from going very deep into the organization, there's just a lot of problems. And I kind of have the feeling that without different ownership, those things can't change. There's too many levels of things that have to change. Because a manager, you know, what's the average time for a manager to have his job? What's the average time for a general manager to have his job? Probably double the managers or triple the managers. I think every GM ends up having like three managers or something like that on average, right? And then you go up, every step up the ladder, you go, someone's there a little longer. But those big changes that you make, like with the organization, how the farm systems run, how you're recruiting, how you're scouting, those take longer than the tenure of the GM. I mean, this is why things like the Cardinals happen. This is why the Rays are in the place that they are now, is because they changed ownership, and it took them a few years to get that going. And now they're able to – how many years did that take? You know, now we're like 10 years into that ownership group, and it's like, oh, this is – they've got it figured out.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, on the one hand, Han hasn't been in charge for very long. On the other hand, it's hard to identify which decisions are coming from whom, because you have Reinsdorf there. You still have Kenny Williams there. I mean, Kenny Williams is clearly still very involved, and you do have to wonder how much of the problem he is, or how much of a benefit he is, looking at his, because we now have a lot of track record for him.
Yeah, and at some point I feel like it might end up, you know, some sort of like partisan politics thing going on. Like, you know, they're just constantly redoing each other. I can just see a situation where they're not always looking in the same direction, and it's kind of stalling progress.
And so here's another thing too with Han is I still think he's good. I still think he's probably good. I do want to point out, though, I saw people saying, listen, none of this is Han's fault. He's only been around for so long. He was the assistant GM for like a decade before this. So
right, and that's what I mean.
He had a lot to do with it before he was the GM. I mean, whether he had the final say-so, he declined to interview for a lot of other general manager jobs. Presumably he wanted to stay. So he was on board with what they were doing.
That suggests he had a lot of power. Or at least a lot of influence, a lot of say in the moves the White Sox were making. He felt valued enough not to need to go to another organization.
Yeah. So,
and that speaks to the structural integrity or lack thereof. I mean, it's just, I mean, and certain things. So since Rick Hahn has come officially to the helm, there's been a number of things that have happened that you can't really completely blame him for. They're just things that just haven't worked out. So I can understand that. You know, it's not Rick Hahn's fault. And to some extent, it just has to be because he's the guy that makes those decisions on paper. But, like, you know, last season's bullpen plan with the ground ball pitchers and, you know, and Nate Jones to bail out, that failed. But it was a good idea.
Yes.
The signings they did this year, you know, a lot of them, or a couple of them seemingly looked for this year to be it. Melky Cabrera and Adam LaRoche, for instance, back end, that maybe might seem a little weird. And any time you sign a reliever for more than a few years, you're questioning the back end. But that should have worked this year. I mean, even going back in time, you know, if you have no absolute knowledge that what happens in 2015 is going to, you're still thinking that those still look like smart moves.
And he did acquire Adam Eaton, and his awful start aside, he's trending back toward where you would thought of him before this season. You know, he's got his strengths and he's got his weaknesses, but he's a net positive player.
Yeah, it's nice to see Eaton come around for multiple reasons, obviously, because, hey, we're stuck with him at this point.
Right.
He does do a lot to, you know, the whole joke about straw that stirs the drink. He's that guy. I mean, he starts it off literally, you know, in the game, and figuratively as well. He's a lot of energy, and if he's dragging his ass because he's not playing well, there's not a lot of energy coming with that. But
he's hitting for more power also than I think. I mean, he was always a doubles triples guy, was where his power was going to come from. But he's already got 5 home runs, which is interesting.
And
so,
what's pleasing to that is it's not like if those 5 home runs came at the beginning of the year when he was struggling otherwise, we would very quickly be showing his approach and being like, hey, dude, don't sell out for power. You're not that guy. But he's doing it in the midst of maintaining what we hope to see from Adam Eaton on a regular basis. It's not coming at the cost of anything.
And it also makes his approach more sustainable because if you're, you know, if you're a guy, and this is something that always fascinates me about a guy like Luis Castillo's career, where if the worst thing I'm going to do to you, if I hit the ball, is I'm going to hit a single, why would you ever walk me? Is sort of how I look at it. And Eaton, the biggest part of his game on offense, I think, is that he gets on base, really. And if there's no power at all, then pitchers are less incentivized to walk you. Granted, he's not a threat to steal a base, so that component's missing. But you don't have to hit a ton of home runs for pitchers to at least be careful. Like, at least show them, like, look, dude, if you groove a batting practice fastball down, like, I can do some damage. Like, it's not likely, but you actually have to think about what you're throwing.
So Adam Eaton hitting home runs is like a power hitter bunting against the shift.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. They're identical.
So, also, coming around of late is Melky Cabrera.
Yes.
Which...
go ahead.
Which is, I mean, another thing that, hey, now is a guy that we're stuck with it, so we need to see something here. Just signs of life are great, and so it's nice to see that. And between the two of them, who are kind of opposite sides, I would say, of the emotion spectrum, the in-game emotion spectrum, like, Melky always kind of looks bored.
Yeah, he's very chill.
But I think that you can see in the dugout when he's going well the difference when they pan in there when he's going well as opposed to when he's looking like he did the first 2 months of the season.
And this is what's brutal about how badly the season's been going is because in Robin's defense, the thing that he hasn't done that, like, say Sandberg did was that the clubhouse still seems to really like him. The players like him. And that's important. It's important to like your boss or your supervisor, right, or whatever it might be. Similarly, you look at, you know, Eaton, Melky, and Abbasale. By contrast, you know, you say LaRoche is a this year move. Samardzija is a this year move. Robertson, to an extent, is a this year move. And, you know, Melky, obviously, yes, they hoped to compete this year. That's part of what that signing signaled. But it's a 3 year deal for a player who's, I think he's what, 30? 31? He's 30. So it's not his value isn't entirely this first year. So he's the type of guy where you're looking at, you're hoping that he winds up recovering to being the player you hoped he would be when you signed him going into next year and the year after. Because if you can actually get good production from him in years 2 and 3 of the deal, then you don't come out feeling so badly. And it looks like those three guys have a good camaraderie. I mean, you see him interacting out in the outfield, you know, when Abbasale catches a ball in right field and the Eaton one's coming over, you know, they laugh, pat each other back, whatever it is. So that's there. It's definitely there. What was promising about Melky's game today is because he's been, you know, scraping along and slightly improving for the last, I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at his game logs for the last month and the improvement hasn't quite been what you might have hoped. He's been hitting 264 with a 316 on base and 345 slugging before today. So he has a pulse, but it was faint. But today, his home run at bat was so wonderful because it was against David Price. He fouled off, he spoiled off pitches. He worked it to, I believe it was did he work it to a full count when he hit his home run?
I am not sure. I don't recall.
But he hit it. He was right-handed, which has been
right,
a big problem for him this year, and he crushed it.
Yeah, that was not an accidental home run at all.
No, it wasn't just, all right, his grounders are finding holes more now, and his little flare balls are falling in more now. Like, he annihilated. I think he hit it like 450 feet.
Yeah, I didn't hear an estimate on how far it actually went, but at that point in time, I was on the Tigers radio broadcast, and they were marveling at the distance, saying to that part of the field, that's one of the furthest they've seen this season. They were pointing out that they see further, harder hit balls into center field, but guys that are straight pulling it like that, they just don't see it.
According to ESPN Stats and Info, it was 450 feet, his longest since 2009. So something, anyway, something really loud that you can...
Like,
and it wasn't just that it was the one swing, too. It was that he worked that at bat, and he identified the pitch as soon as it was out of Price's hand, because I think it was off a breaking ball, and I think he had to he kind of reached down to get it, and he just destroyed it. So that was reassuring, at the very least, in terms of, you know, thinking about next year and the year after, because that's where we're at.
Yeah, as long as we're thinking about next year and the year after, Eaton and Melky are, I think we can be in agreement that they're staying around.
It would be so expensive and speculative to try to upgrade on them.
Right.
There's nobody internally to replace them. You're not going to just cut them, and they're young enough and have shown a baseline previously. Like, yeah, these guys are with the team for at least one more year. If you want to try to move Melky for the last year of his deal, that's a decision you make in 2016 or later.
And currently there are holes, like actual gaping holes, that make it so that you would not worry about these guys being just average if that's what they end up being.
Right.
So kind of dismantling a little bit and looking at trade. I mean, number one trade piece is obviously Jeff Samardzija.
Yes.
And there's some concern that we've expressed in, I think all year, as soon as things started going sour and we realized it was a possibility, about what sort of return you can get for a guy that's a pure rental, that's going to free agency, and that's having a year that's not in line with what we expected when we acquired him.
Yeah, and what's troubling too is that last year was, you know, this Smarge has always been a guy whose appeal came from his build, his athleticism, and his stuff. And it wasn't necessarily translating to the results you'd hope for until last year. And it was the type of thing where you think, okay, he's figured it out. He's tapping into his stuff. He's one of these guys who's actually reaching his potential. And to have this year as another data point in his career, it makes last year look that much more like an outlier, which at least if I were trading for him, I would certainly negotiate from that perspective. Like, listen, you know, he doesn't have this great track record as far
right.
as performance.
There's something specific missing. If like the main symptom is the strikeouts, which have precipitously declined. So I feel like there's something identifiable there, and anybody with confidence in a pitching coach, despite the fact that I realize there is Don Cooper here, but anyone with any sort of confidence in their pitching coach might be able to say, look, there's obviously one thing missing. There's one thing. There's a variable here that's changed, and let's see if we can't address that.
You could argue, though, that last year with Oakland was the first time in his entire career he's pitched in front of a decent defense. His peripherals are better than his ERA, and they have been for a lot of they have been, you know, frequently in his career. The White Sox defense has been abysmal this year, so I do think that that's not helping. And also, you know, if you want to talk about, well, you know, there's arguments for and against leaving Samardzija in today. Look, dude, pull him with the shutout, because, like, you know, it's a good look. It's a good look. Don't leave him in to get knocked around.
Yeah, again, when you have bookended days off, it just doesn't really make sense to push it like that.
So apparently there's still plenty of interest. Cafardo reported today that the Royals, Tigers, Twins, Blue Jays, Yankees, Cardinals, Orioles, Angels, and Dodgers are all interested, as well as the persistent rumor about the Astros. And I joked early on that the White Sox repeatedly rolling over for the Twins is artificially propping them up as a contender, and it's going to trick them into thinking they should buy, much to their chagrin. Evidently, I was right, because they keep handing him wins.
Well, they're actually a team that's probably pleased with Jeff Samardzija's declining strikeout rate and might actually try to acquire him because of it.
Yeah, no, that's true. I'm of the opinion that that you should trade within your division if you think this makes them better in the short term, but the short term doesn't matter to me, and it makes me better and them weaker in the long term. And you could argue that trading within your division is a better thing to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the goal of a trade is always to win the trade, to get better than you were before the trade. So, obviously, who you're trading with shouldn't matter as long as you're getting better.
And neither the Twins nor the Royals are re-upping with Samardzija if they trade for him, right? I mean, neither team is going to put that kind of money on that kind of guy, right?
Not very likely, no. But weirder things have happened, especially with the way money is working in baseball right now.
Yeah, but if you trade him, the comp pick issue goes away. So Samardzija's got to be rooting to get traded because he's going to get a lot more money.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering about that. I couldn't remember how that would go. So there's a few things that are working good for the White Sox here. A, there's so many people looking at him.
Yes, more buyers equals higher price.
I mean, he does look worse than he actually is, because if there's any time that's awful for you to just strike out guys less, is when you're playing with the White Sox 2015 defense behind you. So it kind of makes it look a lot worse than it actually is as far as the final numbers go. And B, we're not forced, the White Sox are not forced to make any terrible trades because, hey, they're at least going to get a draft pick out of it if they don't.
Yeah, they don't have to, and it's next year's draft is supposed to be very attractive.
So that's leverage right there. So there's leverage because of the team's bidding. There's leverage because of the fact that they can just say, screw it, and keep them.
Yeah, and...
Which means they probably won't keep them, by the way. All those things add up to a better package in an eventual Jeff Samardzija trade.
I would hope so, and I guess it's kind of nice, like I said, the blessing about them being as abysmal as they have been is that it makes it very unambiguous that they should be selling. They haven't played themselves into that gray area. I mean, I'd argue if I were the Twins, I would be, I don't know, I don't think I'd want them to be buyers because, like I said, you know, if you take the White Sox games out of their schedule, and I know, like, then you're already messing around with reality, but bear with me for a second. If you take the White Sox games out of their schedule, they're a 500 team with a negative 40 run differential.
Yeah, I don't need to even take the White Sox out of it. The Twins are just not good, and I don't think anybody that's not clouded by, you know, just blind hope actually has a thought that the Twins are a really good team. And on the other hand, I mean, the White Sox are fully capable of handing a team a division, as we've discussed,
They handed
the Cleveland Indians.
Yeah, exactly. They went 2-17 against Cleveland. What was that? 2013.
Yeah, and they scooted into the wild card there. But
Go ahead.
Nope. Two.
Samardzija would definitely really help the Royals or the Tigers. I think moving forward, certainly the Royals are somehow still just cruising along despite having one and a half starting pitchers.
Yeah, they've got a really weird thing going on out there and are making it work.
looking at that list, I'd be terrified about them. They have a past relationship with the Blue Jays. They made a number of trades with the Blue Jays. As silly as it sounds, I feel like the White Sox have kind of a track record where they pick a couple organizations that they have good relationships with and make a lot of deals with them. I think they've made a lot of deals with the Diamondbacks over the years. I mean, part of that makes sense because it follows with the traditional wisdom of you're trading players as far away from your division as possible.
It makes sense to do that just because, I mean, anything you do and you're comfortable doing, you're going to keep doing it that way.
I'm terrified of them trading with the Cardinals because the Cardinals are so much smarter than they are. I don't really have particular feelings about the rest of those teams there. Otherwise, I know the Blue Jays trade surplus. They have a ton of arms in the minors. Unclear as to what the return would be there. I don't see the Orioles doing that just because that hasn't been their MO. They haven't really. I guess they went out. They made the big swing for Andrew Miller last year, and I think it's kind of. I think they haven't really come out looking great from that. Even though I get the thought process, the piece they gave up is pitching great for Boston now, and obviously Andrew Miller pitched like 20 innings for them or something like that. So
yeah, that's definitely got. I mean, not to this extent, but I mean, it's the type of thing where it did what it needed. Doyle Alexander, like. What you were trying to do worked for you at the time, but long-term, it's probably going to be goofy.
And I don't really see – I mean, if Samardzija is going to pitch more like an innings-eating three or four, I feel like the Orioles don't have any issues with innings-eating mid-rotation guys. I feel like they've been able to churn those out. They'd want a frontline guy if they did do the uncharacteristic big move ad. That's my reaction to it. Off the top, they seem like kind of a prospect hugging organization, you know, along the lines of, I don't really see Texas giving up guys like that either, but.
Texas always does a pretty good job of replenishing what they've got. So I feel like they wouldn't be scared to part.
They did it for Garza. They definitely did it for Garza. Texas did. So I don't know. It is good that if it's true that there are still eight or nine bidders, that's fantastic. It drives up the price. The sooner you deal him, theoretically, the more valuable he is because there are more bidders out there. And, you know, every single start is a significant percentage of his remaining value he's only under contract for the rest of the year.
Yeah, time's running out at this point. I mean, it's July next week, and that leaves him, what, 5 to 6 starts? before the deadline.
Right. So, and only, what, 15, 16 more starts for the rest of the year? Maybe more, maybe 17?
Yeah,
17 or 18?
The sooner the better, obviously. I mean, you want to get more bang for your buck. And the one team we didn't mention just now, and I think it's because... So, here, something interesting is, and I don't know if this is how the actual front offices work, but this is how the fans work, is a team like the Dodgers, who could use a starting pitcher because they've been having some issues back-end-wise, and they don't need a guy to be obviously 1-2 because they have a couple of the best in the game right now. But they're kind of penalized because they have some really strong prospect pieces that all of a sudden that would be the asking price, and it's like, well, it's that or nothing, and... should that really be the case?
Well, I think the nice thing about a Samardzija rental is you cannot, with a straight face, ask for the well, now Jock Peterson's an everyday player for them, so you can't ask for Seager or
right.
Urias, whatever his name is, for 15 possibly mediocre starts from Jeff Samardzija. You can't. Like, it's not even... It's a non-starter. So, in a way, because you can't plausibly ask for those things, maybe you can actually just cut to an actual productive conversation about some of their other pieces. I have not familiarized myself with their farm system beneath their blue chip guys, which I think is where most people are. I mean, I think Grant Holmes was their first round pick last year. I've been hearing about Alex Verdugo for a long time. I'm just looking at the BA top 10 coming into the season. I mean, they have other guys, and the White Sox are in no position to turn up their noses at prospects of any sort of pedigree. But it may be that the shape and distribution of their prospects isn't a fit.
So speaking of fits, I think Margulis said a couple weeks ago, and I don't remember exactly how he phrased it actually, but receiving a position player prospect would be possibly wasteful for the White Sox. This kind of goes back to our organizational problem.
Right.
So,
because they don't know how to take a non-finished product and
right.
make him major league ready.
So are there any teams that would be in a position to want Samardzija that would even have excess guys that are ready now? I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Oh, somebody at, like, the major league level?
Yeah, because that's really, I mean...
Like an Eaton type.
Like, yeah, exactly, like the way they did with that. Somebody that's kind of like an extra for a position type of thing. Like, he's already done as much learning, you know, in the lower levels as he needs to do, but we can't use him. We have nothing for him. I mean, and except for, obviously, Schwarber is too much.
I would have said... Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe the Cubs have some sort of fit there, but a lot of those guys that you're talking about are still in that Matt Davidson territory where they've had a cup of coffee or they've seen them. You know, Alcantara's been in the majors a little bit and Baez has been up, but they still have development to do. And if you've already just conceded,
yeah,
which, by the way,
the
is
White Sox
terrifying.
Javier Baez a strikeout problem.
No. I mean, I don't know that anybody will, but it's certainly not going to be the White Sox. It's troubling that if you're already, I mean, maybe it is correct to say we cannot do this, so let's not bother with the assets that will be that require a skill we do not possess. But God, that's such a you're so behind the eight ball if you're trying to compete with these other organizations and you can't do it. If you are at that place, I mean, that could be true. That could be true, and that may be where it is. But whether the organization realizes it, if the organization has realized it, I don't know how we haven't heard about like 30 people being fired already.
Yeah, that's another thing.
So it's troubling if that is the case and they don't realize it. That's a different problem. Or if they do realize it and they refuse to do anything about it, that's another horrifying possibility. There's a lot of like possibilities that we can't give a definitive answer, but many of the potential explanations are nauseating. So a little grim there. I guess Texas, I would have said, would have been in a position like that recently. But Odor struggled so much and he's still so young that he still, I would say, falls into the category of guys who need seasoning.
Yeah, I mean, Odor would probably be, he's probably straddling that line or pretty close to it, where if they were willing to not have him around, that would make sense, especially considering the White Sox are kind of patchworking second base.
I was thinking of Pittsburgh, but I don't know that they need an arm, really. You know, somebody like how they have Mercer and Harrison and Gong.
Pittsburgh also has, and I haven't read the book yet, but I've heard a lot about it and about their whole process and mindset, and I don't think they're the type of team that wants to have anything to do with Jeff Samardzija.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't. And it's not the type of I put them with Baltimore, where they're a team they're an organization that's not going to want to shop outside mid-season like that. Just they don't come to mind like that in that group of teams.
The Giants are one of those teams like the Pirates as far as mindset goes, but they could probably also use somebody like Samardzija, and that park would be good for him on top of that.
Well, yeah, certainly. Like I said, the Cardinals have lost some of their depth to injury. So, and they're so good at churning out pitchers. Cafardo reported that they're interested. So I have no reason to doubt that, really, unless they're just trying to drive up the price for their rivals. But.
So what about the idea of trading for a guy now who would traditionally be a guy going to a contender that's really looking for some help? But with the, you know, guy that's definitely not a rental, but the team he's on is not going to be good enough for him to actually contribute in the next few years, and they're not going to be able to re-sign him when the time comes. I'm looking in the direction of a man who just hit another home run, Todd Frazier.
Oh, you think in terms of Cincinnati being a fit?
No. I mean, Cincinnati can do what they want. I mean, they're definitely sellers, but I mean, the idea of the White Sox not buying for this year, but buying for next year through trades at this time of year. I mean, is the cost just too high because of the teams that are in the market are...
Oh, I see. Identifying another seller, grabbing one of their longer-term assets to set up for 2016.
Correct.
I know a lot of people talked about targeting Frazier. I get the idea. He's under team control until he's only through next season, correct?
Yeah, it's something where it's
he's under ARB until through 2017.
He's basically just going to be expensive, and by the time he gets to free, like, they're pretty buried. They're not like, I don't get the feeling that they're a team, and I don't know if they identify themselves this way either. Maybe they don't feel the same way, but I don't think they're a year out from being good.
Yeah. I guess the most recent comp, if you wanted to move him, would be like a Donaldson type. I don't think his glove is where Donaldson's is.
Yeah. You'd need similar to the Donaldson thing. You would need some sort of organizational disconnect for them to want to part. I mean, the price would be so high that it's basically damn near impossible that would ever happen. But, I don't know what kind of precedent there is for two selling teams trading a player that has win-now capability.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on that, although I am sure that it's happened. With Frazier, the problem is that, you know, as we discussed, I don't think you were on this podcast, but the last one we did where we kind of came down to and thought, well, geez, the only things that they can really sell that anybody would want to buy are Samardzija and Soto at this point. Otherwise, you're talking about moving stuff out of the farm system for Frazier. And I guess that feels like an off-season move.
Right.
But even if you did that, you'd be looking at having to deal Tim Anderson. They still don't have much down there. They really don't.
Yeah, that's the thing, too, is like if there's an inability to develop down there, like, what are you really losing if you're turning guys loose? Or if you're sending guys out for other items?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, do you have a thought of as to whether that's even plausible? Or maybe that's an example of something, but maybe an asset that's less valuable than Frazier. I mean, because Frazier is having, like, an MVP caliber season.
Right, like that in particular is very – that's not likely at all, but – you know, that might be the sort of approach that kind of, I don't want to call it a loophole, but kind of gets them around kind of their development situation to some extent. And I don't know, maybe the problem is there's just not much value externally on their prospects, even if the prospects are likely to be better having had more development time outside of the White Sox system.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, I haven't looked. I'm going to pull them up, but I think even Josh Fegley's hitting well this year, which is...
I don't think he's hitting well. He's just not...
He's hitting two... So. Yeah, no, he's killing the ball. He's hitting 293, 349, 545.
Oh, wow.
He's annihilating the ball. And he was... He was a sandwich pick who was a bat first guy. So this is just another data point potentially. I mean, it could just be 100 at bats, but this another data point where even when we steal the Oakland's hitting instructor, they like it doesn't matter. They're still better at it.
That's. I mean, at the major league level too. I don't know. He was a minor league instructor for the A's and. I don't know, once the guys are at the big leagues, I don't think they're going to do a whole lot of... They're not too open to suggestion, and I've heard managers and hitting instructors say this, like, it's hard to even get guys to listen. They've obviously had a certain level of success to get to where they're at. And you can suggest things and hope that maybe they say, oh, yeah, let me look into that.
Well, I think that that's one of those sentiments that I would file along with people are more confident about their ability to project pitcher injuries than is realistic. And I would also file that away with the appeals to managerial, you know, the expertise and professionalism of – it's like, well, he's a manager, so he knows better than you do. Because you can look at J.D. Martinez, and he's a guy where Keith Law was like, no, when he was with Houston, I didn't see him succeeding with that swing. He went to Detroit. They changed his swing, and he's now a – functional corner outfield bat. Yeah,
more
so
than that.
like obviously it's one example, but it can be done. And that sounds like a personality thing. I'm sure that there's some bats where they're like, no, this is what works for me. Even in the face of the fact, like, look, dude, for the major leagues, this like really isn't that great. But yes, you are one of the 700, 800 best players in the world. That's not that great for a major league roster. But there's got to be other guys who are like, geez, I'm not doing as well as I think I'm capable of. This guy's got some ideas as how I can do better. I'm sure there are players – like, that's what those plus makeup guys are, right?
Yeah, the coachability guys, yeah.
I mean, Paul Goldschmidt's someone who we've all just now filed him away as elite superstar, but he's another guy who Law identified as someone who, through coachability and work ethic and intelligence, has transformed himself from a platoon bat second division starter first baseman to an MVP caliber player. So I don't buy that coaching and development is non-existent at the major league level. I really don't, because you have organizations who acquire, not just develop things from the outside, but acquire players from the inside, but acquire players from the outside, and they play up at certain things. The White Sox do it with pitching a lot of the time, but Detroit and St. Louis come to mind immediately with where they acquire bats and they play up. Like Cespedes is having one of the best years of his career. J.D. Martinez is another example. Anthony Goes is going from a guy who can't hit at all to someone who you could actually play like periodically. Castellanos is an interesting wrinkle there because he was supposed to be a good bat prospect and he looks like he doesn't know how to hit. It's not a perfect, not saying that, you know, these organizations can't make mistakes, but then you have on the other side teams like the White Sox and Seattle, who, no matter what they do, no matter what talent or money or draft picks, you name it, they throw it an offense, they cannot put one together.
Yeah, and the Mariners at least do have a couple players that are position guys, positional guys that they did develop. The White Sox, Carlos Sanchez and Gordon Beckham would be the only ones that you could call everyday to semi-everyday players that are positionally, there's White Sox drafted.
So I saw the argument that I saw an article saying, well, Seattle's farm system is doing just fine. Like, they're doing great. Don't criticize them because look at how many major leaguers they've produced. But they produce major leaguers on Seattle. Like, the bar is lower because they have nobody.
No, like, I mean, yeah, but I mean,
like, you can't, like, yes, Kyle Seager is a triumph for them, but Just because they're using Ackley as an everyday player doesn't mean he's an everyday player. As we've seen with the White Sox, where they ran out Dion Vicieto with their starting left fielder for 3 years, no other team is interested in using him.
Right. I mean, I would never call the Mariners farm system a success. I mean, I'm just saying that there's at least identifiable players on their roster that they drafted that are, you know, playing on a regular basis, and the White Sox don't have that.
Yeah, I get it, but I just think I see what you're saying, but I also think it's a tautology to say, well, look, they're on the roster, they made it to the majors, we developed them. If they're terrible, then, you know, it's kind of a moot point to me. Well, like Gordon Beckham is a glove. They still haven't taught. He doesn't know how to hit.
Right. He's doing the same thing he's been doing, which is put together some streaks here and there.
And Sanchez is a glove. He can't hit either. So
he really can't hit.
So right. So if we're talking about an organization's ability, whether it's at the major league level or the minor league level, to get a certain percentage out of a player's ability, Seattle, I think, is a little more damning because I think they've done less with more talent. You know, if you look at guys like Ackley and Smoke and Montero, you know, those guys had warts, certainly, but those were better regarded hitters than anything the White Sox have had their hands on in a while.
Right, and the Sox have, I mean, maybe there's some credit to the White Sox for not forcing it. I mean, they're obviously forcing it with Sanchez here, but, you know, they are actually fielding guys at positions, whether they're performing or not, and they're not just saying, well, we need to use our guys that are internal. One of the things they've had success with, obviously, Jose Abreu and Alexei Ramirez, who...
Oh, no.
May not be around too much longer, just by virtue of is he playable?
It's really frightening because, you know, he's never been a patient hitter, or anything resembling a patient hitter, and he's shown a propensity to go through long slumps, and you know that I think players are streakier on a granular level than fans typically realize. But, you know, I remember, like, okay, well, Alexi never hits in the month of May, for example. That was just a truism with him. But the process is looking particularly terrible. I mean, there's at bats where, you know, he can really afford to relax and just wait for a particular pitch. And he's just, everything is a weak grounder to short. He chases absolutely everything. It's hard to watch. I mean, I've always been such a huge fan of his. The power is gone. I don't know. I mean, his walk percentage is about where, you know, it's been for the last few years. The strikeout percentage is about where it's been for most of his career. But his ISO is just the lowest it will have been his entire career. And granted, his BABIP is really low, but if everything's a weak grounder to the shortstop area, like, you shouldn't expect that to improve.
So this season, there's two shortstops that are older than 34. Alexi will be 34 next year, which is the option year. Jimmy Rollins and Clint Barmas. Barmas is actually doing fine. He's 36, actually. And that's
How is Barmas amazing. That old?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised by that. But Rollins is dead weight at this point, so we'll see. My point is, shortstops of that age just don't generally age well. And I mean, Derek Jeter last year was 40.
Peralta's 33 right now, and he's killing it.
Peralta is just constantly exceeding expectations. I mean, he, after his initial not hitting his expectations, once the bar got lowered on him and no one expected anything, he just started killing everything.
Yep. Well, he also has spent the last, including this year, six seasons in those two organizations that max out players' hitting ability. So it's Detroit and St. Louis.
It's, I guess what I'm trying to say is the idea that Alexei will recover anything that he's had in the past, even in the small amount of success that it's been offensively, we're not going to see that again. And defensively, we're just looking at a straight decline.
It's weird, too, because his – just looking at – I don't know. I don't know if it's really been publicly available, or I don't really know too much about how well it's put together, but this year they've got the soft, medium, and hard contact percentage up on Fangraphs, which I think this is the first year it's been really publicly available. But his batted ball profile, as far as that goes, is like completely in line with his entire career. His ground ball percentage is like 1 to 2% higher than it's. I mean, I don't know. Do you think he's just getting unlucky, maybe? I mean, the components here don't look that different from the last couple of years.
I mean, that's part of the streaky thing, I'm sure, which is why. I mean, I guess when you're talking about Alexei offensively, it depends on what stage of the streak you're talking. You know what I mean? Like up arrow, right, down arrow thing. So, I mean, your opinion, if you're very short-sighted, your opinion could change a great deal week to week. But I'm really more concerned with, like you said, we kind of just accept certain things with him offensively, especially at a shortstop. But it's the defense that bothers me. It's because we could always lean back on that before. And, you know, he still kind of makes a lot of those simple mistakes that he's always kind of had here and there. Save for there was like 1 year where he avoided those a whole lot, which I think was that Omar Vizquel year. But you just see him being slow to things. There's balls that you like, he probably would have had that a year or two ago, and he doesn't get to those. I don't know if it's first step. I don't know if it's total quickness of range, but it just looks different. He looks different out there than he has in the past.
I still think he's a solid defensive shortstop. He's just not a plus to elite defensive shortstop like he used to be. But if he can recover, like next year, if he has another year like he did in, you know, at least offensively, like let's say next year he's an average shortstop, or even let's say a below average shortstop defensively, if he has an OPS of like 650 to 700, which is slightly below his career track record, isn't that worth the option? I mean, like, what better choices do you have out there?
Yeah, that's the two things with that is it's hard because he's so – that just happened, you know, that year where he had, you know, a great offensive year. That's very recent. So you don't want to act like it didn't happen. And then, yeah, it's – and I know you talked about it a while on the last podcast. It's just there's no other options. Like, shortstop's weak.
Like, that's the thing is, even though this year so far has been the worst season of his career by quite a bit on offense, he's still got like 150 points of OPS on Carlos Sanchez, who I think would be your next man up at shortstop, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Sanchez is not.
Or Lory Garcia? I mean, what the hell else do you have there?
There's no way to go, and you'd have to go externally, and the cost would be so high for that because the positional scarcity is such that no one's going to give up a shortstop that would qualify to play every day.
Oh, boy. Do you think you get anything interesting for Soto?
No, probably not. You probably get some small piece of, you know, like some little lottery ticket type.
Right, some sort of, no, that's what I'm saying, like a high A reliever or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, something like that seems possible. I don't see anything wrong with that either, because, I mean, again, it's not a lot of long-term value to us, so take what you can get. And that's the type of thing that people get pissy about is like, oh, like last year, the Dunn and the Gordon Beckham trade, but it was like, look, these guys are not going to bring any value. So just take anything you can get. Literally anything you can get is fine.
Right. Like if you've got food in your fridge that you're not going to eat, like, I don't know, trade it to somebody for like a bag of chips you can throw in your pantry and like eat later because it's going to go bad. You know, it's just, either you can let it rot, or you can swap it out for something that anything that'll be worth something later. And I think like I was surprised that like Deaza got nothing, and then Dunn got back Sanburn. Like, that was weird to me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's all about the need, you know.
Right, but like Sanburn, I mean, he's brittle and he's a reliever, but like, I don't know. He was a second round pick, and he like still throws really hard, and he strikes a lot of guys out. Like, if he turns into a middle reliever in like 2 years, would you be surprised at all?
No, and I mean, and that's part of why you do these things. You're like, you know, maybe someone will give us something that they've just completely given up on.
Right, because in a season like last year where you're like, oh, God, this bullpen is just so freaking terrible, you only have Putnam and Petrichko. It's like, well, like, let's say if Sanburn works out to be another guy of that order of, you know, a flawed but definitely usable middle reliever, then it's the organization, the whole profile of the bullpen shifts. The shortstops available in free agency for next year are Joaquin Arias, Mike Avilas, Willie Bloomquist, Bloomquist has to retire after this year.
These are all players that they're not even running out. Bloomquist, they barely play at shortstop. Avilas is playing outfielder.
Asdrubal Cabrera. Ian Desmond is definitely the most interesting one. I'm not interested in Ian Desmond. Steven Drew. Alcides Escobar is going to have his option picked up.
Escobar's a second baseman as well now, isn't he? And I would assume that Desmond is probably on that same trail.
Yeah, all these guys, like Mysers, Turris, Cliff Pennington, Sean Rodriguez, Jimmy Rollins, like these guys have been shortstops forever. And even looking at the second baseman who could play there, yeah, there's nothing here. Like Zobrist, I guess? Seems weird to sign Zobrist at age 35 and run him out there as your shortstop. But
no, yeah, that doesn't make much sense. I mean, that's the A's are choosing to play Semien there instead of putting Zobrist there, if that says anything.
Is Semien still getting regular
PC? I don't know how often, actually. I haven't watched an A's game in a couple weeks, but I hope not for their sake.
Right.
I guess I've seen some recent things about him having an error. That's usually... Twitter is usually pretty good about Semien error alerts.
Right. Oh, no, Zobrist has not played a game at short all season.
Yeah, so that's... There you go.
I also can't believe that Clint Barmas is 4 years older than Cliff Bennington. In my head, they were like the same sort of thing. But I guess Barmas had the distinction of destroying the ball with the Rockies when he first came up, and then, falling down a flight of stairs with deer meat?
Is that what happened?
Yeah, he...
The injury is sounding familiar to me, but I wasn't connecting it to him.
He was carrying a bunch of deer meat up, like, a flight of stairs, and he, like, fell down. And... Yeah, Marcus Semien is leading the majors with defensive games at shortstop.
That's rough. That's rough rostering.
But, I mean, if he's going to his OPS is down to 707.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely fallen off. It was just to be expected. I mean, I had no doubt. I was surprised it stayed past spring training when everyone was like, look at what he's doing in spring training. And then when he had the actual April that he did, I was surprised, but under no delusion that that would remain.
He would have been nice for this roster.
But anyways, I think we've gone on plenty.
Yeah, it's true. I wish that there were something. I mean, Samardzija is definitely the most enticing trade piece. Here's the thing, though, before we move on. If you're not going to pick up Alexi's option, you should trade him, right?
Yeah, I think he's worth, again, with positional scarcity there, somebody can use a guy like Alexi Ramirez. But going back to it, I mean, that just also says that so can the White Sox. As much as the fans are maybe upset at him for being Alexi Ramirez, which they were even when he was good, you got to have a guy out there. It's just the way the rules are set up.
and that's the thing too, is if we're trying to decide, okay, well, we need to get rid of somebody. At least Alexi, I can point to reasons why you keep him around.
Yeah.
Like, the reasons to keep Ventura are so tenuous at this point. I mean, the arguments are the sort of thing where, well, manager doesn't matter. The players like him. And that's kind of it. I mean, to his credit, it seems like he's willing to change when he gets burned by something. Like, when he didn't make that obvious challenge in that, I think it was a Tigers game. In the days afterwards, it sounded like Han was like, look, we had to talk about, like, the game theory on this, and in certain situations, you need a challenge even if you aren't sure you're going to win, just because, dude, what are you saving it for? But, and so he's changed a little bit with that. He's moved Abreu into the second slot. I don't know if that means he's been reading Jim Margulis about, who's been very, who's been pushing that idea. And it's, supposedly it's objectively correct to have your best hitter hitting second. And I think it's,
I mean, total lineup matters, but when your lineup really sucks, it really makes sense to do that because please let me see less of these guys that suck.
Right. You're just, you know, give a higher percentage of your at bats to a, just a, one of your two or three competent hitters at this point. And so he's shown a propensity to learn, but the process of hiring him was so dubious and ridiculous. And it's been 4 years. You've given him a fair shake. I know some of those rosters were pretty terrible, but even in situations like 2013 where it was a lost year, like he killed Addison Reed and Nate Jones' arms for no discernible benefit. And he just doesn't – I think he's overmatched and he's very replaceable. So it's just – you know, if you're gonna kill somebody, I mean, Alexi's been really good for a really long time. I think he's earned the benefit of the doubt, or at least in this situation he has. It's not like he's the difference between them going to the playoffs or not. If you're concerned about going forward for next year, I just don't see Ventura being able to take a team to the playoffs without overwhelming talent, and that doesn't seem to be a position the White Sox are going to be in for some time.
Yeah, they won't be. And I just shrugged my shoulders with the Ventura thing. I mean, I had some hopes when he got brought on with no experience. I get very excited when someone gets brought on with no experience because I feel like maybe they'll do things differently. Maybe they won't be so closed in and just doing the standard manager things that are, you know, conventional wisdom says that aren't actually wise. But
leaving Robertson, paying Robertson $12 million to sit while the house burns down.
You know, things like that. The guys that are willing to try things differently, and that's another thing we've talked about a lot. You know, Showalter, Madden has done that. You know, just Bochy does things that are differently sometimes. Just guys that do stuff that they're not scared of being called out for being wrong on, you know, because it wasn't the whole go for it on fourth and eight type of thing, you know, like the not automatic punting stuff that it doesn't always make sense, but you don't want to. When you're wrong, then you'll get skewered for it. I wanted to see that. I wanted to see someone doing it differently, but Robin Ventura doesn't seem to have that. And so that calls into question why they were so insistent on bringing him in.
But, and on a positive note, the White Sox are not the only team that people thought could compete this year that have humiliated themselves. The Indians are still shooting themselves in the foot. The Boston Red Sox have been similarly atrocious, and the Red Sox too. I mean, they had 2013. Their front office, as presently constituted, doesn't really inspire a ton of confidence at this point.
Yeah, they definitely did some things that were. I thought that was interesting because they were definitely trying something, and but they needed a lot to go right, and it didn't.
Even how they succeeded in 2013 didn't necessarily. Every champion gets lucky. Like, don't make no mistake. You know, if you've got a bunch of good teams, the one that's going to get the best luck is going to win it. But I don't think that they were necessarily doing anything that wasn't even that good for 2013. I think it just kind of worked out. So I don't even know if their decision making is that good at this point. I don't understand hyping up prospects if you're not going to trade them.
They're in a position where they definitely can make a lot of moves, and I'll be interested to see if they choose to or not, because they're saddled by these contracts now that they kind of need to hang on to these low-cost new MLB guys, you know what I mean, to balance that out.
Well, yeah, I mean, Bogarts and Betts Betts is working out better than I thought he would because he's apparently better in center field than I thought he would be, but Bogarts has been wonderful this year, and you know those are the types of guys where, and of course Brock Holt's been a superstar. Those are the types of guys that are really valuable, and you can move forward with them. But I don't know that you want to flip those for arms at this point.
I'm more disappointed with the Indians because if it wasn't going to be the White Sox making a thing in the division, I would have enjoyed watching a successful Indians team just based on their pieces more than I would with anybody else, just because the Royals still bug me a bunch and kind of tired of the Tigers, and the Twins just weren't a possibility. So having the Indians struggle so much, it's not as satisfying as it, you think it could be for an in-division meltdown.
No, and I the Indians, other than the Indians are my least hated team of those other four in the division. I definitely, if, like you said, if it wasn't the White Sox, I'd rather be the Indians, because those other three teams just bother me. They really annoy me. So it is a shame. But like I said, the White Sox aren't going to be the only ones at the end of the year. I mean, the Mariners were supposed to be. I get a perverse satisfaction about the Mariners failing, the Red Sox failing. So they're not alone. It's not like the White Sox are the only team that's had plans for this season that didn't come together.
So here's one: if the Mariners are constantly being overrated in projections because of their park factors, we've now had because of the White Sox offense, a declining park factor offensively. So next year, are the White Sox going to get the benefit of the doubt because now their 3 to 5 year window of park factor has shifted enough that it makes them look better than they are?
Right, because it'll come in and it'll say, well, Alexi's going to OPS 650 because that's his track record. And, hey, in that park, 650 is awful great. And then, yeah, we're off to the races. Yeah, I don't know, because I don't think projection systems are comfortable projecting they don't really, as time has gone on, they've clumped closer and closer to median average performances.
Yeah. So
they don't really anymore. They don't seem to capture Melky Cabrera going half a season with a sub 600 OPS. They don't really capture Alexi Ramirez going half a season with a sub 600 OPS. I don't even think they're comfortable going out on a limb and saying Carlos Sanchez is going to OPS 400. I don't think that that's something that they do anymore. Or they don't, Baseball Prospectus, at least, and I haven't looked at in a while, but underneath Silver would do weighted probabilities of collapse and breakout years. So it's trying to present to you, hey, okay, here's the guy's likelihood that somebody does, you know, basically what Alexi and Melky have done to date, or what Dunn did in 2011, or what Sanchez has been doing all year, where it's just, it is the worst you can imagine sort of situation. I also wonder, and this is something that I was thinking about coming into the podcast. We were talking about problems riddling the organization from top to bottom, and talking about Kenny's role here. And it's hard to slam Kenny Williams in some respects, obviously because 2005, et cetera, and he must do some things well. But part of it too is that is this concept that eluded some people about Moneyball, is that yes, Moneyball was about getting guys who got on base, but bigger picture, Moneyball was about trying to find value. In other words, finding assets that are undervalued.
Right.
And I think when Kenny Williams came in, he picked up on something, which was that, you know, there are certain, like, number two, number three starter types who have 2 or 3 years of control that teams are undervaluing. That he was able to get Freddy Garcia and Javi Vasquez, for example, for prospects that didn't really turn out to be much. And obviously the Freddy Garcia trade was fantastic. He did with Cologne also. There wasn't as much control there. But he was identifying these mid to top rotation arms that, you know, weren't aces, but they were particularly valuable. And that was a trick that he's tried to pull off. You know, he kept going to that well over and over again. He did with Peavy. And I guess that worked out. Peavy was a disappointment in many respects, but he didn't really give up any. Those prospects didn't turn into anything.
But you're definitely right. I never really noticed that as a game plan, as an attack plan, but that guys that were either expected to be aces or were falling off of their ace status and grabbing them when that was happening.
And it was
definitely
a
thing.
It was cool that he did it. He was like, okay, this is a market inefficiency. And it made sense given his constraints, because Reinsdorf doesn't want to go long-term with pitchers. And at the time, there's the conventional wisdom that pitching is super, you know, pitching is, starting pitching is the main asset. And it makes sense why it would be. But I would argue that in this era of offense has been suppressed quite a bit, offense is down league wide, that pitching might not quite be as valuable as it would have been 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And you just wonder if, you know, Williams had some good ideas and he executed them pretty well. And obviously the team was generally good under his tenure. And then he obviously had some huge weaknesses, but you wonder if that his influence on decision making is outdated, that because assets don't, you know, that the market doesn't stay fixed.
Oh yeah, you gotta ditch anything that you do that you're kind of exploiting anything. You gotta ditch it once everybody's onto it. It's no longer, I mean, that's not complicated.
And like Theo built up a lot of his reputation by a lot of moves that got made before he came in and stuff, or him just applying that one principle of like, hey, dudes that get on base and strike out a lot are underrated. And he pulled in, you know, Bellhorn and Bill Miller, or what have you, and all those other guys. I guess Miller's not a strikeout, but you get my meaning. Like, he had a trick that he used repeatedly and it worked really well at that time. And then once the secret's out, you have to figure out something else. And I worry that the White Sox main strength is less valuable than it used to be.
Yeah, I don't think he's the type that has the sort of mind that can continuously come up with those things. I mean, you want someone that can continually, obviously, figure out what's needed. I mean, you want someone who can figure out what people want, not just create Napster. You know what I mean? And that's,
yeah.
I mean, that's cool you had that, but now it's done, and now you're done.
I've had just about enough of your Napster bashing.
All right, so on that note, let's cut it out here, and hopefully by the next time we talk, there's at least a little bit more substantive talk about trades, or maybe even an actual trade.
Yeah, I'm on board.
It is the season.
And hopefully this horrible holding pattern is approaching some sort of change, and with. You know, with Rodon, you know, the other change that we could be looking forward to is Eric Johnson supplanting Danks, but with Rodon skipping a start and their innings control situation, since the season's lost, I understand hanging on to Danks where it's just, well, you might as well let him go out there and wear it.
Yeah, I imagine they're going to start being very, very careful with Rodon and skipping and things like that, so... And likewise, I don't know. Johnson's a guy that definitely is worth at least bringing up now, because it's the things he needs to do is get major league hitters out for the most part, especially with this whole new recovered profile of his. But like, I'm just glad there's not guys we're trading away at positionally, because to see like the team that they'd be putting up there would be awful. like trying to run like. I don't know, who would you be running out there at this point? I mean, Saladino, I guess people have been calling for a little bit. People are like, keep saying, let's just throw these guys out there and see what happens since this team sucks. But it'd be totally useless to like bring Trace Thompson up type of thing.
Right, and because, you know, for those people who are saying that, you know, Carlos Sanchez is a guy who was like, well, he may never hit for much power, but look, he's having these like 10 straight hit plate appearance hit streaks, and he's hitting, I don't know, 300 in AAA. He can't handle it. Not even close. He can't even pretend to handle it. So I don't see why somebody who's not as polished or not hitting as, you know, has worse pitch recognition or worse contact skills is going to do any better. I mean, granted, maybe the fact that Trace Thompson could hit the ball out of the infield would mean that he's not going to get pitchers being super aggressive against him because they're, you know, they have to be a little careful. At least he could be a mistake hitter. Maybe that's the difference. Maybe it's that Carlos Sanchez can't punish mistakes. But, there's nothing other than Rodon. There isn't really too much to watch in terms of major league level development this year until Johnson comes back. And sorry, as you were trying to wrap up on that note, I guess maybe those are the next things to look out for.
All right. All right, until the next time.
Farewell.